Exploring women's relationship to money and what it can teach us.
One of the things I wanted to do with this little book was to model stories of generosity so that other people would be inspired to be generous themselves.
That's Christian McEwen. We talk with her about her newest book, Legal Tender, Women and the Secret Life of Money. Then a conversation with Nation contributor Ellie Mistal about his chilling examination of how Donald Trump and the GOP have packed the courts with ultra-right-wing judges and reshaped the judiciary for a generation. His cover article for The Nation is Donald Trump and the Plot to Take Over the Courts. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm host and producer Francesca Rhiannon. And hey, do you know you can go to writersvoice.net to sign up for our free podcast and weekly newsletter? Find extra content there with links, book excerpts, and extended interviews. Christian McEwen is the kind of writer who pays attention to the things we often don't talk about, but which underpin some of the basic drivers of how we live our lives, or how we should live them. We last talked with her about her wonderful book, World Enough and Time, on creativity and slowing down. Now she's come out with a slim volume exploring what money means to women. Women who have it, women who don't have it, and women who give it away to those who need it, no matter how rich or poor they are. Composed of interviews McEwen started doing after the financial collapse of 2007, Legal Tender illuminates the lies, secrets, and silences beneath our discomfort over money. It focuses on childhood memories, adult challenges, the joys of generosity and abundance, and the inequities of race and gender. Legal Tender challenges the reader to explore our own relationship to the tender mercies of money, and perhaps to transform it. Christian McEwen is a writer, educator, and cultural activist. In addition to Legal Tender and World Enough and Time, she's the author of Sparks from the Anvil, the Smith College Poetry Interviews, The Alphabet of Trees, A Guide to Nature Writing, and a book about her uncle and mentor, Music Hiding in the Air, among other publications. Well, Christian McEwen, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
What a pleasure. Thank you.
So this little volume, this pithy little volume, Legal Tender, Women and the Secret Life of Money, how did you get started in this project, which actually led to a play and now to this book?
Well, it began long ago. It began around the time of the Great Recession, which was 2008, early 2009. And I was listening to NPR, as everybody was, to find out what was happening in the world. And I heard many, many stories that had to do with economics, and almost none had a female pronoun. And so in the spring of 2009, I began to interview women about money. I just saw there's a story needing to be told there. And I gathered more than 50 interviews over the course of the next 4 or 5 years, some of which were then braided into a play that was performed in my local town, Northampton, Massachusetts. And some of which I started carrying out into the world at banks, credit unions, colleges, gatherings of women philanthropists, really anywhere that I could use the stories as catalysts to get other women telling their own stories.
And you say in the book that talk about money is all about lies, secrets, and silence. Why do you say that?
It's remarkable how often people don't tell the truth about money. I mean, I think in the first place, people don't want to talk about it at all. But the statistic that stays in my mind is that 31% of Americans who've combined their finances with their spouses say that they've lied to their partners about money. And of these, 58% said they hid cash, 15% hid a secret bank account, 11% lied about their debts, and 11% lied about how much money they earned. So there's a desire to keep things secret.
And sometimes there may be a very good reason to keep things secret, right?
Well, I think yes, for sure. I mean, one of the stories in that book is about a woman who wanted to leave her husband, and she was afraid to leave him. And her friend said, well, you must open a bank account, you know, and he mustn't know about it. And the woman said, yes, but he goes through all my things. He'll find it. He'll find it out. And they ended up hiding her bank details inside an empty tampon applicator. And she managed to gather the money, and she managed to leave the marriage. So there are some extraordinary stories.
Oh, they are. There are just fascinating stories in this book. Starting out actually with yours, you don't really tell everything. I mean, I know you outside of this book because long time ago we did a project together where we interviewed well-known poets who came to Smith College, and we aired those interviews on Writer's Voice. And I remember you telling me that you grew up in a very, very large house, a mansion, kind of a Downton Abbey type of mansion. But it's clear from this book also, and from what you told me, that your parents did struggle for money. So how was the relationship to money when you were growing up?
Yes, when I was 8, we moved to a big house in Scotland. And when I say big house, I mean bigger than the White House. It had 113 rooms. It was enormous. Beautiful Adam house built in the 1750s. 3,000 acres of land, fields, hills, rivers, a moor. I mean, beautiful, beautiful place. But my father had inherited that house and that land without having the money to run it. So there was a perpetual anxiety about money in my childhood. There were also 6 children, and a level of expectation of how to maintain life that was by no means supported by what was in the bank. So I think people who've had a complicated and an entangled relationship, or have seen their parents have complicated and entangled relationships with money, are probably more likely to do the sort of investigation that I did myself. And probably growing up, as it were, both rich and poor at the same time, meant that I was a trustworthy interlocutor for the people I interviewed, because certainly I've known both ends of the spectrum.
And how would you characterize your relationship to money from the rich point of view, and how from the poor point of view?
Well, I think I grew up in as it were, rich surroundings. I mean, beautiful place, dilapidated, you know, beautiful and dilapidated. And I had a good education, which is partly because of the way the British education system runs. I didn't come out of college with a great big debt. And then on the poor end, I mean, I've essentially lived by my wits since I was in my middle 20s. And as you know, writers don't easily make enough to live on. So I've always been teaching on the side or doing various odd bits of work on the side, essentially trying to create enough time to do the writing.
Yeah. Now, what kind of women did you interview, and where did you find them? I mean, at least in the beginning.
I started with my own friendship network. And because I have friends, as it were, of all classes and races too, I just jumped right in with people I knew well who would be willing to trust me with their story. And then people would refer me to other people. So some folks I knew pretty well already, although interviewing them on this subject certainly deepened the intimacy. And some I barely knew at all, like I interviewed some financial advisors and such whom I never saw again.
You start out with a story about a gambler. Why is a story about a gambler the entry into the stories?
Just thought it was a very punchy story, and that she wasn't afraid of talking about money. And in that way, she was a contradiction to most of us, I think. She was very willing to say things, to tell it like it was for her.
And do you think that has something to do with just, you know, her ability to gamble? I mean, do you think that gamblers may have an easier way talking about money?
No, I mean, the gambling was for her horrifying and secret for many years. But what she says in that excerpt is, I'm not embarrassed by money. I'm not embarrassed by having it or not having it. And in her case, she had a father who was a CPA and a mother who was a bookkeeper. So she grew up, as it were, lower middle class, I guess you would call it, in New York City. And she says, what I learned was easy come, easy go. There was respect for people in our house, but absolutely no respect for money. So I think that lack of respect gave her a willingness to speak.
And the second story, it was so interesting. It was a young woman, Charisma. Tell us about her.
She was a young African-American student at a local college here in Massachusetts. And I was introduced to her through an academic who she'd worked with at the college. And she really trusted me with some hard stuff. I was very impressed by her courage in telling me that story.
Tell us a little bit of her story.
Well, she'd grown up with her mom on disability. They were on government assistance. Her dad was only in the picture till they were six. There was shortage of money right through. I mean, the classic thing was that she was on government assistance. Her mom didn't have a job. Of course, government assistance comes in once a month. And the result of that was that things got very tight by the end of the month. So the kids really had to make sure to eat at school, and they all got free lunch. And she was very valiant about it. But this is what she says. And you hear in the way she speaks a kind of hesitation that's to do with her wanting to talk and at the same time pulling back from talking. It was tough for her to tell this story. So she says this, I did feel, you know, sometimes left out when my friends wanted to go out, especially my best friend. She always wanted to go out and I'd have to tell her, no, I don't have any money. And then she was like, well, I'll just pay for you. And I'd go out. But at the same time, it's just, it's not my own, something that I can, you know, be proud of spending. I wouldn't fully call it shame. I have this weird thing where as I go through, I guess, obstacles and hardships, I turn it into determination and motivation. So I saw the pride and the shame in a way warring in her as she described this to me. She was doing her valiant best to cop to how hard it was and at the same time not be pulled down by it.
And she was also the recipient of a remarkable act of generosity. And that's, you know, another side that you examine in the book. You examine philanthropists and ordinary people who just kind of come into something, a windfall, and then they pass it on. And this remarkable story of somebody at the college who helped Charisma stay in school.
This was toward the end of her years at the college, and she, Charisma, as I call her, was struggling to pay her college bill. And she wasn't getting help from the financial aid office, and she wasn't getting help from the president's office. And when she went to the president's assistant, the assistant wasn't very kind to her, and she felt she was being mistreated because she was African American. So she went to the dean's office, and she was crying. And she was explaining her mother didn't help her, her father didn't help her. She only gets $80 a week. And if she had to pay them the bill that was due, she really couldn't make it. And Letty, as I call her, just said, I'll write you a check. And this was no small check. This was a check for $6,000 to $9,000. But Letty sat right down, wrote that check, and absolutely opened the gates of freedom for this young woman. It was astonishing. And she was crying as she told me the story. She was still utterly amazed by the amount and by the generosity.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. I'm speaking with poet and author Christian McEwen about her latest book, Legal Tender, Women and the Secret Life of Money. It's out from Bowen Press. Just to receive that kind of generosity is amazing. But I also think of the person who gave it. You didn't have a chance to interview her, did you?
I didn't. The person who gave it is a good friend of mine, and I didn't actually interview her. I think part of why I wanted to do these interviews was because when people are generous in this way, they very rarely are the ones who blow their own trumpets. So you have to get the story from the recipient. But the recipient often doesn't want to tell the story because they have some shame about being rescued in this way. Or the person who's given them the money has said, I'll give it to you, but please keep it quiet. So I felt like one of the things I wanted to do with this little book was to model stories of generosity so that other people would be inspired to be generous themselves.
Well, it's interesting that you know this person, because I was trying to imagine what she felt like when she was writing that check. Do you want to speculate, just knowing who she, knowing her as a friend?
Well, she said to me, she has somebody who manages her money, and this woman's name is Lisa. And this friend said to me, I'm spending Lisa's skill, which is to say that Lisa has been able to invest this friend's money in a way that has made it multiply. And therefore, she feels she has more than she expected to have. And one of the pleasures that is then available to her is to help people out.
Now, you also use this section to talk a little bit of, actually, Charisma talks a little bit about, you know, what we call intersectionality, how being African-American and then being a woman, that those are double burdens. And in fact, you know, Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren have been talking a lot about racial disparities on the campaign trail. That struck me when I read a figure that you put in the book that for every $100 of wealth in white families, families of color have just 16 cents?
I think that's the early version. I think you must have been given the advanced reader's copy, because in the version, the final version that we checked, it's $5.04 to every $100 worth of wealth in white families. So it's not 16 cents, but it's also, it's not very much. $5.04 to every $100 that a white family has.
Yeah, that's really shocking. And then you have the story of the 100% Irish woman you interviewed, a woman named Bridie. And she recounted what her grandfather had said. He had told her, if you're ever feeling poor or down on your luck, give something away. Help somebody else and you'll feel rich. And she says that she can remember that there was always enough to help other people, even though they were quite poor.
I guess that was a theme that recurred again and again. And in fact, I forget the statistic on this now, but poor people and women are actually more generous than rich people and men proportionally to what they have.
Yeah, I remember back in the days when I was quite young and I used to hitchhike. Rich people who were driving fancy cars never picked me up. It was always people who were driving the clunkers who did.
That's right. I found the statistic, actually. Let me give it to you. This is from Deborah Mesh, and she says, women, on the whole, are more generous than men, giving away some 3.5% of our income as compared to men's 1.8%. And when you think that the average woman makes 77 cents to the male dollar, that's yet more generous. I mean, 3.5% is almost double 1.8%. Yeah, it is double.
And another thing, and I think this is a theme that also runs through the book, is there are actually very few people in your book who work in jobs that they don't like just for money. I mean, even Bridie, who, you know, after her kids grew up and moved away, she decided she was going to do what she wanted to do, and she gave up security to go and, you know, become a park ranger. She went back to school, became a park ranger. Talk a little bit about, you know, how the people that you know made the choices that they did for, let's say, which even you have made, you know, a choice to scrape together what you need to live while doing what you love to do versus doing something you may not love to do because you need this economic security.
Well, I just jump first of all to Zipporah. Again, a pseudonym, who grew up in a Jewish neighborhood in Teaneck, New Jersey. And her first job was a typist at an outfit called Hart & Company. And she sat there as a young woman typing over and over again, I'm sure you will welcome our entrance to the independent automotive aftermarket. And she did that for a long time just to pay the bills. But then I guess partly it's that the people I was drawn to are people who have at least some level of relationship to money that makes it, for none of the people I interviewed would acquiring money be at the top of their life list of things they wanted to do. Money was about what you could do with it rather than it for itself, I think. So that means it makes for a certain spaciousness, perhaps.
And did you think about trying to interview someone for whom, you know, making money was the primary thing?
Did I? I didn't so much think about that. I think I thought about the philanthropists who had it already rather than people who had been scrambling to get up the... I mean, there's one woman in there, and she's the woman who makes more than her husband. I don't know if you remember this character, but she's called Suzanne in the book, and she ends up earning an astonishing amount of money in her administrative job at a college. She makes $107,000 a year. And she had grown up relatively, I guess one would call it, lower middle class. So for her, there was great exhilaration in making that amount of money, and even more exhilaration in the fact that she, in the end, made more than her husband did.
Now, you do have a section called Not Making It, which is about real grinding poverty. And I want to read just how you open the chapter with a quote from the writer Susan Griffin. "We dealt with hunger. We dealt with cold. We were the ones who held things together, knit one, purl one. We were the ones who, after working all day, made the meals. We were the ones who, if the cupboard was bare, faced the open mouths of our children. And the way we thought grew from what we did. We knew the limits. We knew the length of caring." That's a beautiful quote. What is it from?
I think it's from Women in Nature.
What do you think she means by saying we knew the length of caring?
Well, I think it's partly about we knew we had to hang in there for the long haul, and we knew that that hanging in was not going to be necessarily so easy. I mean, this refers back to something I learned from talking to the financial advisors. Again and again, I would be told that men, their male clients would want to make the most possible money from their investments, and that would be what they would come in the door with and what they would want the financial advisor to achieve for them. The women clients were much more conservative because what mattered to them was to make sure that whatever it was that was crucial was preserved and looked after. So keep the house payments going, keep the children warm and fed, keep them educated, put the money into the safest thing that would allow those things to be insured. They weren't up for taking big risks is what I heard again and again.
Yeah, well, that's certainly true for me. I know that. You know, I had a great lesson about poverty myself when I was 10 years old. My family and I went to visit Morocco, and my mother was, you know, a kind of bohemian person, and we had lived in Mexico when I was a very, very small kid, and she was really enamored of the kind of romantic notion of poverty. And so when we arrived in the city in Morocco, the two little boys kind of appeared and appointed themselves our guides. And my mother asked them, take us to the poorest part of town, because she thought that's where she would find the real people. And what they did is they took us to the poorhouse, the Jewish poorhouse, which was the poorest of the poorhouses. And the degree of, you know, the degradation of poverty that was so extreme, you know, the sense of hopelessness and desperation was the first time I understood the true toll of poverty. It made a huge impact on my life. In fact, I think it was the defining moment for understanding economic injustice, which, you know, has always been a touchstone for my life ever since the age of 10. So I wonder, most of the people in this book, I don't think you interviewed anyone who currently was in that situation, but I wonder if you could just talk of your own perspective that you might have found in listening to the stories of bitter poverty.
Well, I have a similar story to yours in that I went to Thailand when I was 17 and worked at a mission for people with leprosy. This was in between school and university. And I was working up in the northeast in Khon Kaen, which is a very poor part of the country. And it was deeply shocking to see how little people had. I remember in particular one young girl who was maybe 9 years old, and I was working with Catholic nuns, and they gave her a bright new pink little blouse with, you know, white circles on it. And I came back the following year, and she was still wearing that blouse. And by then it was completely faded and degraded and almost rags on her back. And it was clear that that was just the one piece of clothing she had.
And you do actually have, you have a story of someone who got involved with Muhammad Yunus's micro-lending project in Bangladesh. And yeah, and there was a point there where she talks about one family where the mother had been given, you know, a tiny loan, basically to buy some sheep, I think it was, and so she could sell the milk. And she compared the size of her child to another child, perhaps of the same age, and the other child was half her size, you know, which was an indication of just how dire the deprivation was of the other child who had not had access to just enough to really thrive just physically.
Yeah, absolutely. And maybe I'll just read you that little section. She just arrived in Bangladesh in the late 80s, and she was working with Muhammad Yunus, who later won the Nobel Prize. And this is what she said. I remember visiting this one woman, Khalida, when her neighbor happened to stop by. You know, when a foreigner comes, everybody swarms around. And the kids are hanging around behind their mother's saris, and I'm trying to get a sense of who is who. Khalida had only been in the borrowing group for a couple years, and her neighbor wasn't a member. I'm not sure why. And what was so dramatic was that when they introduced me to their children, Khalida's 3-year-old was the size of her neighbor's 6-year-old. And it was because of the stunting and wasting that goes on when kids don't have enough to eat. All of a sudden, I could see the differences right there. Those first 6 years of a child's life are so important. And I became just rabidly committed to trying to go as fast as possible because you could see the cost of going slow in real human lives.
I know, and so many, you know, in so much of the political discourse, it's just kind of assumed that, oh, we can make incremental changes and it'll eventually work out. And, you know, what is forgotten is the real cost in real people's lives.
Yeah. I mean, just to back up, I think there is one story, I don't know if you remember, but there's a Tibetan woman whom I call Tashi, and she comes to this country, and she works and she works and she works, and she saves saves almost everything she makes and sends it back to her family in India. They're all in Dharamsala around there. And imagine sending $3,000 back to India inside of 1 year when you're making, you know, the minimum wage, and you already have 3 children and a husband and a life to support. I mean, it's really an astonishing act of conscientious generosity.
So what was the most surprising thing you found in the course of doing this project, first the play and now the book?
Well, I mean, I guess there are two things. One is simply that you think of this as a subject that people don't want to broach and that they are afraid of broaching and embarrassing and shameful and complicated and all of that. And I think that's true. But I also think that once you get the door cracked open even a little bit, there's a real hunger, even a passion to tell, because so many of us have this uncoordinated knot, money knot inside of us. And the relief of trying to unkink it is tremendous. So I'd say that the stories are waiting to be told. And the second thing I'd say is just that, as I mentioned earlier, in relation to the generosity of those with less, the sense of abundance is an inside job. There are people I met who have a great deal in their bank account who are quite wary, quite cautious, quite reticent about what they have. And then there are others who have much less and who are somehow able to be spacious and generous with it. So abundance is about one's own relationship to what one has, not so much about whatever the money, whatever the figures are.
Did doing this book change your own relationship to money?
I think up to a point, if I'm honest. I mean, I still go on having a slightly, as an independent freelance writer type, you know, money is not always there when one needs it. So, I think it's given me a sense of companionship. I don't blame my particular single self so much. I see my place in a larger scheme, I guess, is what I'd say.
Well, Christian McEwen, this is, as all your books are, just a lovely and thoughtful examination of the topic, Legal Tender, Women and the Secret Life of Money.
Thank you so much, Francesca. It's a treat to be able to talk to you.
Christian McEwen. Find out more about her work and her writing workshops by going to writersvoice.net. Next up, how Donald Trump and the GOP have packed the courts with ultra-right-wing judges and reshaped the judiciary for a generation. We talk with Ellie Mistal of The Nation. That's coming up right after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. I invite you to sign up for the Writer's Voice podcast and newsletter at writersvoice.net. You can find more great content there, including web-only features like book recommendations and extended interviews. While most of Trump's offenses could be overturned by a new president with a stroke of a pen, Trump's court, or courts, will be his legacy. Nation contributor Ellie Mistal reports how the 45th president has unleashed a swarm of conservative judges on the federal circuit courts. In doing so, he's effectively reshaped the judiciary for a generation. These judges are anti-environment, anti-choice, anti-LGBTQ, pro-gun, pro-deregulation, hostile to minority voting rights, and to claims of racial or gender discrimination. They're largely young, inexperienced, and stridently partisan. In his cover story for The Nation, Donald Trump and the Plot to Take Over the Courts, Ellie Mistal profiles the seven injustices who exemplify the worst of the worst of these lifetime appointments. Ellie Mistal is executive director of Above the Law and legal editor of WNYC's More Perfect podcast. Ellie Mistal, welcome to Writer's Voice. Your article in The Nation about the Trump court is absolutely terrifying because it's not just about the Supreme Court, but about all the appointments that are being made to federal courts around the nation. You point out that Trump won't be president of the U.S. forever, but that his court will linger like an infected wound poisoning the body politic even after the initial injury has scabbed over. Give us the dimensions of this infection.
So the stat that I like to use is that Trump has, and again, this is not just about the Supreme Court, Trump has successfully appointed 123 judges to the federal courts. That includes 41 judges to the Circuit Courts of Appeal, which is the rung right below the Supreme Court, which is hugely important, we can talk about. By the same point in his administration, Barack Obama had appointed 19 judges. So Trump has, and you know, it's not Trump's idea, but Trump and Mitch McConnell and the Republicans have really successfully remade our federal courts in their image. And that is going to be a problem for pretty much any kind of progressive, liberal, democratic policy that you might want to have over the next 30 years, right? Like, these people are appointed for life. Technically, they can be impeached just like a president can be impeached, but we know that Democrats don't really have the stomach for impeachment in a lot of situations. So these people are going to be there. They're generally young. These people are going to be there for the next 20 and 30 years, stymieing progress. That's why they're there.
You say they now account for some 14% of the federal judiciary and more than 22% of the judges on the nation's courts of appeal. Tell us, for those of us who are kind of ignorant of the structure, How does this whole system work?
First, we have to start where we're in the federal court system, right? So the state court system is like where you get charged with arson and where your parking tickets get decided. And it's all those kinds of local issues. The federal courts are where some of the bigger picture constitutional and legal issues play out that kind of affect an entire region. And that is why at the circuit court level, we call them circuit courts of appeal, because each circuit handles a specific region of the country. I live in New York. I'm in the Second Circuit. In New Jersey, we have the Third Circuit. In California, I'm sure you've heard of the Ninth Circuit, right? So all of these circuit courts decide most of the law in this country. To put that in context, the Supreme Court, which everybody is supposed to care about, knows they're supposed to care about at least, heard 70 cases last year. That's out of 7,000 cases that were appealed to the Supreme Court from the circuit courts. The circuit courts are why certain companies try to incorporate in Delaware as opposed to California. The circuit courts are why we have different access to abortion based on which side of the state line you live on. So the circuit courts are extremely important. And while liberals are kind of only now realizing, hey, this Supreme Court thing kind of matters, the Republicans already figured that out and have been working tirelessly to change the nature of the circuit courts of appeal for a generation now. Trump is providing them a victory here that they have honestly been working towards for 30 years.
And you know, you say the Democrats haven't really had this in their sights. Wasn't Obama stymied from being able to actually appoint judges? So it's not just about appointing bad judges, but keeping good judges off the bench.
Exactly. Again, none of this is Trump's idea. Trump, I don't believe, is smart enough to. Trump doesn't know the difference between the Circuit Court of Appeals and, you know, the traffic and small claims court, right? He has no idea. But Mitch McConnell does, but the Federal Society does, but the Heritage Foundation does, but the Koch brothers do. These are the people who have orchestrated this conservative takeover. So everybody understands that Mitch McConnell blocked Barack Obama's nominee to the Supreme Court, Merrick Garland. Everybody saw that. Everybody was kind of shocked by that. Blocking Merrick Garland was the capstone on Mitch McConnell's entire career plan of obstructing Barack Obama nominees, right? Merrick Garland was the tip of that iceberg. Even when McConnell was a minority leader of the Senate, he was very successful in blocking or retarding the ability of Barack Obama to appoint circuit court judges. And then once he got the majority in 2014, basically all appointments stopped, which means that when Donald Trump took office, there were 106 vacancies open on the federal judiciary. I don't know if that's a record because George Washington also had a lot of seats to a lot of vacancies to fill. But in modern times, 106 seats is legendary. And that is a big reason why Trump has been so effective at reshaping the courts. So you're absolutely right to say that this isn't kind of completely Democrats' fault or Democratic malpractice. McConnell has been working against them at every point. But the other side of it here is that, again, when I say that they've been planning this for a generation, what I mean is that the Federalist Society in particular has been going into law schools, identifying potential conservatives, helping them, training them, incubating them, pushing them towards particular clerkships, particular law firms, particular legal positions, so that when they finally had 106 seats to work with, they had a raft of, you know, 200 judges that were bred specifically for this moment. The liberals have no bench like that. If the incoming president, if Trump loses in 2020 and there's a Democratic president, if there are open seats, we don't have 106 people that we know already that we want to put on the circuit courts, right? We haven't done the organizational work to have that kind of bench. We haven't been identifying people from the law school pipeline and helping them out throughout their careers to be progressive judges, the way conservatives have been incubating conservative judges.
So in this article for The Nation, it's going to be the cover story for The Nation about the Trump court, Ellie Nistel. You talk about the Federalist Society. Tell us about these far-right legal arsonists, you call them, like the Federalist Society.
Yes. Yeah, so the Federalist Society is a nonprofit organization that claims to be concerned with conservative legal principles and libertarian ideals. And that sounds, that takes the blood out of it, doesn't it? You have probably heard of originalism. It is a theory of constitutional interpretation promulgated and made famous by the late Justice Antonin Scalia. And according to originalists, all they're trying to do is to apply the Constitution in the way that the founding fathers would have wanted it to be applied. What originalists say is that they're not anti-women. They're not anti-minority rights. They're not anti-gay. They're just doing what the Constitution requires. And if the Constitution happens to require laws to be anti-women, anti-gay, and anti-minority, well, that's just how the framers wanted it. This is a bad argument. This is a bad theory of legal interpretation. Put it like this. I do not care what 18th century slavers and sexists had to say about voting rights for minorities in Georgia. There is an entire other kind of legal theorizing that says, no, the Constitution as written was a flawed document and was not perfected until after the Civil War with the 14th Amendment. And that is where we should kind of situate all, like, everything in the Constitution needs to be read within understanding of the 14th Amendment. This is the legal battle. What the Federal Society has done is that it has generally won the kind of language debate over how we should talk about the Constitution. And as I've said, they have generally won the training debate, so that if you are a conservative lawyer in law school, you are trained to think this way pretty much from the time that you hit campus. And then you are promoted throughout the kind of conservative enclave into particular clerkships with particular judges, into particular law firms, taking particular cases, arguing those cases from a particular point of view, increasingly to judges who have also been trained just like you. And so that's what I'm talking about in terms of the long-term organization of the Federal Society. But it's not just them. As I pointed out in the article, there are lots of other conservative groups that have kind of figured out that they cannot get their anti-democratic agenda through unless they control the courts. So you have, for instance, the inaptly named Judicial Crisis Network. All they do is run ads promoting conservative justices and denigrating Democratic justices. The Democrats don't even have an ad arm, an ad agency, in charge of running ads to support and defend their guys. If you think back to the Merrick Garland confirmation battle, you'll remember seeing a bunch of ads on TV just tearing down Merrick Garland, and literally no ads on TV saying, hey, maybe the President of the United States should get to appoint a Supreme Court justice, right? So you got people like the Judicial Crisis Network doing that work. And then obviously the money that flows in. I've already name-checked the Koch brothers, but the Koch brothers, the Mercer Foundation, the Scaife Foundation, there are powerful donors behind these efforts of the Federalist Society, of the Judicial Crisis Network. On the Democratic side, if you're a Democratic billionaire, are you putting in place an organization that can help take over the courts? No, you're running for president. That's what you want to do with your billions, Tom Steyer. You want to run for president. You don't want to do the work that is necessary to take the courts back from Republicans. Dahlia Lithwick, who everybody should be reading because she's awesome and great. She writes on Slate about the Supreme Court. She has said, and it's a great line, buying a Supreme Court seat is actually relatively cheap in our society. Federalist Society only got quarter of $1 billion. That's not a lot. $250 million is not a lot to buy the kind of influence that a Supreme Court justice has. So what you need is for the Democrats who have $250 million to put that money into the courts as opposed to putting it into their own kind of egotistical political campaigns.
We've seen so many cases where we are depending on the courts as the last line of defense to protect civil liberties, voting rights, regulatory rights. So talk about the issues that are at stake here.
So I got three that I think are particularly important. If you care about the Second Amendment and reasonable gun regulation, you know, wherever you fall on the line, where you want background checks or assault weapons bans or at least, you know, a rule prohibiting ownership of a tank, you have to care about promoting liberal justices, because conservative justices have a view of the Second Amendment that is unbound and unattached to any historical precedent for the use of the thing, and is extremely aggressive and, to me, dangerous. So if you care about gun regulation, you cannot get meaningful gun regulation passed unless you have control of the judiciary. Number two, climate change. The conservatives love promoting judges that believe in what they call deregulation, right? They want capitalism unfettered and blah, 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 blah. And you've heard these arguments from every Republican since Ronald Reagan. When you talk about significant climate change proposals, though, what they're going to require is regulation of our corporate industries, regulation of our consumer products. We are going to need regulation in order to take on plastic, in order to take on fossil fuels, in order to hold back the sea. And conservatives simply will not go for it. So as long as you have courts that are controlled by conservatives, you cannot get meaningful climate change regulation passed. Maybe you can get it passed, but you can't get it upheld. It will be struck down by these conservative judges. And the third thing is voting. All the Democrats say, like, oh, well, you know, the thing that we got to do, we just got to turn out the vote. We have to get people to vote. That's how we take back our country. Man, conservative judges don't believe in voting. They don't believe in voting if you're non-white. They don't believe in voting if you don't have an ID. They don't believe in voting if you are living in a majority-minority state. They don't believe in voting unless you live in Montana, right? So conservative justices are the ones who are putting in place the structure of who is allowed to vote, when they're allowed to vote, and how much their vote is allowed to count. So if you believe in voting, you have to also believe in having progressive judges on the courts of appeal.
Ellie Mistal, in this cover story for The Nation about the Trump court, you single out seven justices, the seven injustices, as you call them. I'm just going to ask you for one or two to talk about them. Chad Andrew Riedler, the child cager of the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. Tell us about him.
I brought Riedler into this for two reasons. One, people are kind of concerned about our immigration strategies right now, or immigration policies right now. And it is important to understand that Chad Riedler is one of the judges that, when he was a lawyer, was Jeff Sessions's right-hand man advocating policies that I believe are human rights violations, right? He has advocated for child separation. He has advocated for departures. In the law, it's called a departure. What it really means is an exception to rules requiring humane treatment of migrant children. So, like, he's been in court saying, no, we should not be forced to give migrant children humane treatment. So he's this big kind of anti-immigrant figure who, as a lawyer, all right, there's always going to be a lawyer willing to take a case. But now that he's been promoted to being a judge, when these immigration issues come up to his court, it is going to be hard to get him to rule that the government has to give children toothpaste and has to reunite children with their families and should not be separating families at the border. Chad Riedler is against all of that. The second reason why I brought him up, though, is because Chad Riedler was defeated. He was nominated in front of the 115th Congress. That's the Congress before the midterm elections. And even though Republicans held a majority, because Riedler is also against the Affordable Care Act, Susan Collins wouldn't vote for him. And that meant there weren't enough Republican votes to get him through to confirmation. But after the midterms, while yes, Democrats had the blue wave and we won all these seats in the House, we didn't take back the Senate. In fact, we lost seats in the Senate. The Democrats are not focused enough on doing the things that are necessary to take back the Senate. So Chad Riedler was renominated after the midterms, and then he was confirmed by a Republican Senate empowered from the midterms. So I bring up Chad Riedler not just because he's this anti-immigration crazy person, but also because he is exactly what happens when the Democrats do not control the Senate. He was defeated when the Republicans only had a one-seat majority, and he was confirmed when the Republicans took even more seats in the Senate.
Wow. Now, it's not just men. You talk about Naomi Rao, the anti-feminist, in fact, the rape apologist, who filled Brett Kavanaugh's seat on the D.C. Circuit and once clerked for Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas. Tell us about her and also Amy Coney Barrett and the threat that they pose to women's rights.
Right. So Trump's appointees have been 78% male and 87% white. So in the piece, I didn't want to overrepresent the women that he has appointed because in general, he has not appointed many women. However, the women he has appointed are anti-women's rights, and that is one of the reasons why they get to be on the court in a Trump administration. So with Rao, you have a person replacing Brett Kavanaugh, who I always try to remind people was credibly accused of attempted rape. You replace this guy with a woman who has written rape apology articles when she was at college, arguing that women who wear lipstick are making kind of a choice. They shouldn't be raped necessarily, but they have to know that wearing lipstick could get them into trouble. She's written against victims who drink. That was in college. As an adult, she called the Violence Against Women Act mere grandstanding. She also doesn't believe in disabled rights. She doesn't believe in LGBT rights. She's a woman who, again, as a full-fledged adult, wrote two law review articles supporting dwarf tossing, which is the practice of throwing little people for sport and money. She does this because she believes that if you can legalize dwarf tossing, then you can also legalize the humiliation of gay and lesbian people under the rubric of religious freedom. That's who's replacing Brett Kavanaugh, just in case you thought that disaster wasn't terrible enough. With Amy Coney Barrett, I brought her up because Republicans specifically want Amy Coney Barrett to replace Ruth Bader Ginsburg if Ruth Bader Ginsburg passes away under a Republican president. And the reason that they want it, and again, they have been explicit about this. This is not me projecting upon them. This is them telling me who they are. They have said that the reason why they want Amy Coney Barrett is because they believe that she will overturn Roe v. Wade, which she absolutely will. And they believe that having a woman overturn Roe v. Wade is somehow better. I think the way that Republicans play identity politics, they think that if a member of the oppressed group joins in the oppression, it makes it harder to see the oppression. So they think that having this woman overturn Roe v. Wade will somehow mollify women who are having their rights taken away from them by the Supreme Court.
Well, now, is there anything that can be done?
That's why that piece is depressing, right? Like, these people are appointed for life. These people are appointed for life, and there's no reasonable way to get them off the court. All that can be done is to vote for Democrats, not just at the presidential level, although of course at the presidential level, but all throughout the system. Again, taking back the Senate is critical if you care about the courts, because the Senate has the power to confirm or deny appointments. So you have to take back the Senate, and then when you have power again, you have to appoint the liberal version of these conservatives. When, you know, Democrats had power, Obama, I think, was an example of this. He tended to appoint middle of the road, yes, liberal, but not too far, kind of moderately liberal centrist to the court, as opposed to the kind of, you know, progressive fire breathers that can really stand up to the conservative fire breathers that are now with us for the next 30 years.
What about states' rights. What about the ability of states, you know, for example, in New York, to enshrine the right of abortion? What about the rights of states to set their own laws, to set their own regulations? Is this a way to fight back?
It's funny. Like, I went to law school. I graduated from law school in 2003. And for most of my life, I've been arguing against states' rights, because states' rights are, first of all, that's literally what the Confederates used to justify slavery. And post-Civil War, states' rights are how Southerners justify everything from Jim Crow laws to anti-abortion regulations. States' rights are always what Mississippi falls back on, right? So it's been funny under the Trump administration to see kind of liberals and conservatives switch their positions, where liberals are now kind of like, man, these states' rights are pretty important up here in New York, and conservatives being like, we need a stronger federal government, right? So part of the position switching is really just, it's not grounded in legal theory, it's grounded in the particular moment of policy. Yes, states' rights are important in this moment, but I think in general, states' rights in a strong resting your values on states' rights does more harm than good. The way that I protect a New York or a California from Trump is to really fight about it on constitutional grounds. The 14th Amendment does a lot of work if we applied it kind of aggressively. The 15th Amendment, which protects voting rights, the 19th Amendment, which protects a woman's right to vote, those do a lot of work. And if we interpret those expansively, I think what we'll find is that we can defend the policies that we want to defend on constitutional grounds without having to adopt the arguments of the Confederacy of the United States.
Elie Mystal. His cover story for the current issue of The Nation magazine is Donald Trump and the Plot to Take Over the Courts. Find a link to it at writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Do you know you can go to writersvoice.net to sign up for our podcast and weekly newsletter? Find extra content there with links, book excerpts, and extended interviews. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.